from WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Hostilities on the Korean Peninsula were suspended 65 years ago, but the war never formally ended. Thousands of North and South Koreans cannot reunite or even communicate with family. Photographer and filmmaker Laura Elizabeth Pohl delves into the trauma in her traveling photo exhibit, A Long Separation. Then photographer Helen Glazier found inspiration in stark, snow-covered tundra. She toured as part of the Antarctic Artists and Writers Program of the National Science Foundation. We ask why the NSF sent artists to the Antarctic.
They want the public to understand the value of preserving Antarctica for scientific research. People care more about things that they can learn about or see and make that emotional connection.
It's on the record after the news. Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Thanks for tuning in during Pledge Week. We hope you find the time to make a financial commitment to WIPR. Every little bit counts, and every little bit helps us create more local programming to keep you informed. Like this interview with photographer and filmmaker Laura Elizabeth Pohl. She's created a mobile exhibit called A Long Separation. It features the photos and voices of Koreans whose families were divided by war. There are thousands of North and South Korean families who yearn to reunite, but since the end of the Korean War in 1953, it's been almost impossible for most. When I spoke with Pohl in May, I asked her to explain the situation that North and South Korean families face.
So when the Korean War ended in an armistice in 1953, it was divided in much of the way that East and West Germany were, where the Soviets kind of controlled the northern part of the country and the Americans controlled the southern part. And this ended up leading to a permanent division when the Korean War ended in an armistice in 1953. And people are not legally allowed to communicate with each other. They can't email, they can't call, they can't meet, they can't FaceTime. And so thousands of family members, they just have no idea what has happened to their loved ones in North Korea.
Can family members ever see each other?
They can. So there have been periodic reunions that are organized by the South Korean Red Cross and the North Korean Red Cross. And these have happened, you know, just infrequently. There have been 20 since the year 2000. They usually happen in North Korea, and about a couple hundred family members will get to go to North Korea for 2 or 3 days and meet their loved ones. It's very structured. There's not a lot of free time. So you maybe have, 4 or 5 hours alone with your family members.
The desire to connect, I gather, it's about even more than just seeing relatives. It's about honoring loved ones and deceased family members.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, in Korean culture, family is very, very important. And your hometown is also a very important part of your identity. So all these people who are originally from North Korea, you know, they can't visit their hometown. They can't reminisce, as you were saying before, about what it was like to be here or be there with their family members. And they can't see their family members. I got interested in this story because my great uncle was a separated family member. He was the oldest in his family. He left behind his parents and his younger siblings. And as an oldest son in Korean culture, it's very important for you to carry out certain rituals and, you know, honor your parents in certain ways. And he could never do that because he was separated from them. And it was really hard to hear him talk about how he regretted leaving, but no one knew they were going to be permanently divided from their family members when it happened.
Your exhibit includes not only portraits, but interviews with the people that you made contact with. Let's hear what David Park had to say on the point you just made.
At this moment, unfortunately, I can then imagine my mother's face, actually. It's a very tragedy, I tried to figure out, but it's very difficult. And also my sister. But my mother's doing and her sacrifice for me, and I still clearly understand and clearly memorize that.
Tell us about David Park.
So David Park actually lives here in Baltimore. He is a separated family member. He was 12 years old, about 12, 13, when he became separated from his family in North Korea. He was originally from the North, and, you know, things were not going well with the war. So he and his mother and his younger sister decided to leave together. But at the last minute, his mother found out that her father had been detained. So she decided to go back to try to help him. And she urged her son, David, to go ahead and try to leave this war-torn area. And so he left in his school uniform. He was carrying a bag of rice. And he never saw his mom or his sister again.
That's photographer and filmmaker Laura Elizabeth Pohl here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her traveling exhibit, A Long Separation, which looks at families divided between North and South Korea. So tell us what people can expect when they come to the exhibit.
So when you come to the exhibition, it's actually a big truck, like a U-Haul truck. And it's wrapped in white vinyl, and the exhibition portraits and all the captions in English and Korean are printed right onto the vinyl. So you'll be able to just walk around the truck and look at the photographs, read all the captions in Korean and in English. Everything is made, like, I designed everything so that it's just like you're at a museum, as much as possible with looking at a truck and being outside. And there's also an audio portion where you will be able to call a phone number on your cell phone and be able to hear portions of the interviews I did with 8 of the 10 people in the exhibition. And there's audio in both English and Korean.
Why did you decide on such an unconventional style of presentation?
I actually originally wanted it to be inside the truck, but when I started contacting potential venues, they told me that I would need to be compliant with the American with Disabilities Act, which was going to be really hard for doing inside of a truck. So then I thought, you know, it's probably better to just do it on the outside. And that way, even when I'm driving around, people will be able to see the photographs and they'll see my hashtag, they'll see the website, they'll see the name of the exhibition.
You are not only the artistic force behind this idea and the photographer, but you are the truck driver.
Yeah, I'm the truck driver.
And you only stay a few hours.
Yeah, exactly. So in most places, I'm there for the whole time that the library is open. I'm visiting all public libraries plus one community center because I want the exhibition to be accessible to everyone.
Was everyone you contacted willing?
No, actually. The last time I went, there were probably about 90% of the people willing to be photographed and interviewed.
Is there one who particularly sticks with you? Whose story?
Yeah, there is. So there is a woman in the exhibition. Her name is Jo Jang-eum.
Let's hear what Jo Jang-eun told you.
My sisters have children and also have a hard life, so they may not have time to think about me, but I have never forgotten about them. I've lived positively and with hope. And now, I can't see the future.
That pain, that longing, I assume you heard that over and over.
Oh, yeah, over and over. And, you know, thinking about it, it really saddens me. You know, these are people who didn't choose to be separated. It's different if you've decided you don't want to speak to your parents or your brother or your sister or your kids. But when it's not something you've chosen, I think it's very, very difficult.
What do you hope people will take away from visiting A Long Separation?
So the first thing that I hope people take from visiting this exhibition is learning about the unintended long-term consequences of the Korean War and just war in general. The second is to think about how we think about people who live in North Korea. You know, in this country, when we talk about North Korea, it's really in sociopolitical terms, and it's quite focused on Kim Jong-un and his regime and how things are there. But there are real people there, like you and me, just normal people trying to live their lives. And some of them are loved by people who live in South Korea, who live in the United States. And so we need to think about them as fellow human beings.
Photographer and filmmaker Laura Elizabeth Pohl. We spoke about her exhibit, A Long Separation, A Look at Divided Families in North and South Korea. She'll be exhibiting the images in Baltimore sometime this fall. For more information, we have a link to her website at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. Also there, a link to the full interview. And something else you'll find at WIPR.org, easy ways to pledge your support for our local programming. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Last December, I spoke to photographer and sculptor Helen Glaser, who toured and made images over the course of 7 weeks as part of the Antarctic Artists and Writers Program, funded by the National Science Foundation. I asked Glaser how such an extreme, austere landscape could afford so much inspiration for her art.
Well, you know, when I first saw the call for applications to this program a number of years ago, that was my first thought, too, is what would an artist do in Antarctica? Isn't it just flat and white? So I was curious. So I looked at photos and I realized, oh, there are mountains, there are icebergs, there are ice formations of great variety. And I was interested in fluid dynamics. I had been reading about growth and form in nature. I was photographing cloud formations, and what was interesting to me is that through the reading I did in books about science for the layperson, I started to see that the movement of fluids, it was complex, it looked random, but if you start to understand some of the background information, you could actually see these patterns in the sky and realize that there was an order. It was a complex order, but it was there. And so I did a whole series of cloud photographs, and I wrestled with how could I get the cloud formations into a sculptural form, but that was difficult because you're only seeing them from one point of view. So I thought, well, these ice formations are the same kinds of forms I'm interested in, but I could walk around them, and I could capture them from different angles. And by the time I did my second to last application, there was also now software where you could create a scan of a landscape form from still photographs.
And I want to ask you how you use that. I want to ask you about that later. But first, let me ask, what was the process to apply to the National Science Foundation?
Basically, you write a up to 15-page document where you respond to various questions. What is the intellectual merit of what you want to do? How are you going to communicate it to the public? Because that's a really key piece. That's why they send artists and writers to Antarctica, is because they want the public to understand the value of preserving Antarctica for scientific research. And people care more about things that they can learn about or see.
Tell me more about what it was like living for almost 2 months in Antarctica. You were there basically when it's summer. You were there
right
November and December.
Right.
What was it like?
Well, it's 24-hour daylight, and it's people always ask me how cold it was. I'd say most of the time, probably in the mid-20s. I think the coldest day I experienced was 10 degrees, and the warmest day was 43. Sometimes it was windy, you know, so then it felt colder, but it was not unbearable by any means.
24-hour daylight. So how did you organize your time? Where did you stay?
Well, on the base, you're in a dormitory with a roommate, and it's kind of like being a freshman in college again with the beat-up furniture and eating in a cafeteria and sharing a bathroom. And then when you're in the field, different camps have different facilities, but they all have a hut that's heated, and that's where everybody eats and does their work. There's electricity, there's internet, and then you sleep in a tent outside. So it's winter camping. They give you a down-filled sleeping bag, and everybody goes off to their tent to sleep at night.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with sculptor and photographer Helen Glaser. So your sculptures are based on the frozen landscape
right
that you saw and documented. And you use the software you mentioned called photogrammetry.
Right.
So what's the process?
You take a series of still photographs with your camera. You take them in a certain sequence and make sure that they overlap. And the photogrammetry software can match the points up from one photograph to the other and read the information about what the focal length of your lens is and actually can create a reasonable three-dimensional version of what the form was like. It's really pretty remarkable.
So how did you decide what that photogrammetry should be applied to?
Basically, if it was something I could walk around, maybe do 180 degrees, or in some cases, if it was something smaller, I could go all the way around it.
So what kinds of things presented themselves?
I did a couple of scans of the sides of glaciers. I walked all the way around an iceberg that was frozen in the sea ice, and then a pressure ridge, which is a sea ice pressure ridge, which is where the ice gets pushed up against the land. And this one is particularly tall. It was about 20 feet tall and very Baroque looking, so I thought it was interesting. And then I hiked up one day with a mountaineer to this field called a ventifact field, and the ventifacts are these wind-eroded boulders.
So these are rocks,
yeah,
that the wind has sculpted.
Right. They've just been pummeled by gravel. That was in the Dry Valley. So there's a lot of gravel, volcanic gravel, and then there are these huge granite boulders. And over however many eons it's taken, they've carved holes in these boulders and these strange shapes. And those I could walk all the way around. You know, when we went up there, it was like, I called it the Surrealist Sculpture Garden. I've never seen anything like that.
What are you working on now?
You know, I selected 33 photos, and I have finished so far 4 sculptures from this project, but I have more files I would like to produce of things that I photographed in Antarctica, and I have more photographs. So, I mean, I would like to keep working on this project, and I would like to see if I can show it, now that I've shown it in Baltimore, to my hometown, I'd like to see if I can show it elsewhere, too, travel it around.
We hope you've enjoyed this tour of the Antarctic through the eyes of photographer and sculptor Helen Glaser. We have a link to the full interview, as well as to her recent images from the Canadian Arctic and Greenland, at the On the Record page at wypr.org.